Chapter 23. Welcome to the NFL. After Norm Coleman's election contest was thrown out in April, it was obvious to everyone that I was going to be seated sooner or later. And when Arlen Specter switched parties 2 days later, making me the presumptive filibuster-busting 60th Democratic vote, my imminent arrival in the Senate became what Joe Biden would call a big freaking deal. Specter had joined Biden in the Senate in 1981, so the two had served together for nearly 3 decades, and it was the vice president who had brokered Specter's party switch. As part of the deal, Specter got to keep his 3 decades of seniority, meaning he would be well-positioned to snag big committee chairmanships over more junior Democrats, even if they had been part of the caucus for years. Also a big deal. But something that a lot of Democratic senators weren't thrilled about. Then, in a May 5th interview with the New York Times, Specter, now a Democrat, was asked who he wanted to win in Minnesota. He said, Norm Coleman. Evidently, Arlen had forgotten that he had changed uniforms. It gave disgruntled Democratic senators a great excuse to strip him of his seniority and send him to the back of the line within the caucus, which they did in an elaborate ceremony involving a sword, a candle, and a silver Masonic trowel made by Paul Revere. A couple of days later, Shriok, Franny, and I headed over to the White House for a meeting with Vice President Biden, who I'd always been a big fan of. The three of us were ushered into the Vice President's office in the West Wing, where we waited for just a few minutes before Biden walked in and warmly welcomed us. Then, sitting on the couch across from us, he turned very serious. "I've been in this town 40 years," he said. "And let me tell you how you succeed in this town, how I got here." He leaned toward me to bring home the import of what he was about to say. "Never promise anything you can't deliver. Never promise anything you can't deliver." I nodded. I understood. I wasn't going to do that. I wasn't going to do that. Then he turned to the little unpleasantness regarding Specter. The vice president wanted to make sure I wasn't offended and wouldn't hold it against Arlen. "Oh, no," I said. "Just tell Arlen that I know it was a rookie mistake." This brought a small, slightly pained laugh from the vice president. Then, "No, I won't tell him that." I nodded, "Okay." Then he turned to business. "Listen, you're going to be seated soon. Might be a week, might be a month, but you're going to be seated. And we've got to get you something. We need to get you something that you can deliver right away for the people of Minnesota." This sounded good. "Is there anything you can think of?" he asked. "Well," I hadn't prepared for this, "I guess completing the North Star line, that's the commuter rail line that's supposed to go from Minneapolis to St. Cloud." The vice president nodded. It was a brilliant nod because it was utterly ambiguous. Maybe he knew what I was talking about, maybe he didn't. God, he was good at this. "But see, right now, it only goes from Minneapolis to Big Lake, which is about halfway to St. Cloud." "Right," he said. "And, well, right after the stimulus passed, you went to St. Cloud, and you said that we were going to complete the line with the money from the stimulus." Another nod. Yes, he remembered. "How much is that going to cost?" he asked. "I think $135 million. I knew that was a lot, but it was a $787 billion stimulus bill." Biden considered it for a couple of seconds, then nodded decisively. "Then that's what we're going to do. A few days after you get seated, we'll announce that we're going to complete that line, and we're going to give you the credit." "Wow, that's great." So this is how things work, I thought. Not so hard, this whole senator thing. It wouldn't be long before I was the crafty veteran, a giant of the Senate in my own right, doling out wise if slightly patronizing and rather obvious advice to newbies. The vice president and I shook hands, and then he gave Franny and Shriok nice hugs. We left the Veep's office feeling good. As we headed out, we walked by Ron Klain's office. Ron had been Vice President Gore's chief of staff and was doing the same job now for Biden. Ron popped out and said hi. "How'd it go?" he asked cheerily. "Really well," I said, beaming. He said we're going to get the North Star line finished up to St. Cloud. Ron knew exactly what I was talking about. How much is that going to cost? He asked with significantly less cheer. I think about $135 million, I answered brightly. There was the slightest pause, me grinning from ear to ear. Then Ron shook his head. No. Huh? That's too much, he said. And then Shriok, Franny, and I went home. Welcome to the NFL. Chapter 24. I Actually Become a Senator. In addition to calling people for money, traveling to raise money, and complaining about how much money I had to raise, I spent some time during the election contest looking for a chief of staff. Stephanie Shriok asked a friend named Drew Lipman, who had been Barbara Boxer's chief of staff, to help me find someone suitable. Drew introduced me to a number of very impressive candidates, but none was as impressive as Drew himself. Eventually, I pulled a reverse Cheney and just offered him the job. Dick Cheney was the head of the search team that, after an exhaustive search, chose Dick Cheney as George W. Bush's running mate. One of the first and smartest things Drew did was to set up a meeting with Tamara Lozado, who had been Hillary Clinton's chief of staff when Hillary served in the Senate. It had occurred to Drew that I might be facing some challenges similar to those that Hillary had faced. Republicans might be particularly wary of me, considering that I had spent so much time heaping scorn and ridicule upon them. While Democrats might be concerned that, as something of a celebrity, I might steal some of their camera time. Hillary had navigated those challenges with notable success, not just earning the respect of her colleagues on both sides of the aisle, but getting a whole lot done for the people of her state. Wow, I thought, she should be president someday. So we sat down with Tamara, who spelled out the Hillary model. Simply put, it's be a workhorse, not a show horse. Go to all your hearings. Come early, stay late. Do your homework. Don't do national press. Be accessible to your state media and to your constituents. That sounded smart to me. I'd be available to Minnesota press and Minnesota constituents. I'd be knowledgeable about Minnesota issues. I'd be Minnesota senator and nobody else's. I finally actually became Minnesota senator on July 7th, 2009. Normally, there are 33 or 34 senators being sworn in on the same day, the first day of the new Congress that is convened in January. Because there are so many, each one only gets three or four tickets for family and friends to sit in the gallery, where they can watch the new or reelected senators take the oath of office from the vice president three at a time. In my case, though, waiting 6 months really paid off, because I was the only senator being sworn in that day. The entire Senate gallery was filled with my friends, my family, my supporters, and, of course, my lawyers, who, in a touching nod to the historic moment, had agreed not to bill me for the 1.3 hours they would spend in the Capitol that day. Many of my new colleagues did me the honor of showing up on the floor for the occasion. Looking around, I saw a lot of my Democratic friends, of course, but also a good number of Republicans who used the occasion to attach a rider to my swearing in that would defund Planned Parenthood. Who says Republicans don't have a sense of humor? My friend, Vice President Walter Mondale, had flown in from Minnesota. He and Senator Klobuchar walked me down the aisle to take the oath of office on Paul Wellstone's family Bible. As soon as I finished, the gallery erupted in sustained applause. I looked up and blew a little kiss to Franny and the kids, then scanned the rows to see all my friends and supporters. Even Mrs. Moline was there, grinning from ear to ear and clapping madly for her fourth-grade student. Pretty much everyone who'd been a key player in my election was there cheering for me, with the exception, I suppose, of Norm Coleman. My new colleagues stopped to offer congratulations. I was especially gratified that so many Republicans turned out. Orrin Hatch, Richard Lugar, Sam Brownback, and even Minority Leader Mitch McConnell himself. And whether it was out of respect for the institution or simply an acknowledgement of the ordeal I'd been through, their congratulations were sincere and heartfelt. I took it as a hopeful sign. I even engaged in some friendly banter with arch-conservative Jim DeMint. "How are things on the far left?" he asked me cheerily. "They're great," I responded. "How are things on the nutcase right?" We both laughed and went on to build a cordial relationship based entirely on giving each other crap. That afternoon, I got on the Senate subway, the Disneyland-style tram that runs between the Capitol and the Senate office buildings, and happened to sit across from Chuck Grassley, another old-school Republican. "You look just like you look on TV," he greeted me. "Well, there's a reason for that," I replied, "but actually, people say I'm shorter than I look on TV." "Yeah," Chuck said with his distinct Midwestern twang. "Guess what they say about me?" "That you're taller than you look on TV." "Yeah, how'd you know that?" "Well, you're taller than you look on TV." "Yeah, well, guess what else they say about me?" "That you're friendlier than you seem on TV." "Yeah, how'd you know that?" "Because you're friendlier than you seem on TV." This was becoming a real meet cute. "You know," I said, taking a chance, "it wouldn't hurt to smile every once in a while." "Well," Chuck said dubiously, "normally what I'm talking about is pretty serious." "Well, you could smile at the beginning, then talk about the serious stuff, then smile again at the end." "Oh, yeah," Chuck grinned. "That's a good idea." I was already making friends, and in fact, Chuck would go on to co-sponsor more of my legislation than any of my other Republican colleagues. Later that day, I cast my first vote, for which I was strongly rebuked by John McCain, widely considered one of the Senate's strongest rebukers, because it had been a vote to defeat an amendment of his that would have stripped anti-terrorist funding for commercial bus lines. But hey, it was a start. Chapter 25, My First Big Win. It can take new senators months or even years to pass their first piece of legislation. It took me 2 weeks, although to be fair, I'd had a long time to work on it before I got there. I first met retired Army Captain Luis Montalvan at an event for the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America at the Obama inaugural. I also met Tuesday, his beautiful golden retriever. Luis told me he wouldn't have been able to come to the event if it weren't for Tuesday. Luis had served as an intelligence officer in Iraq and was seriously wounded in El Anbar province. He returned with 2 Bronze Stars, a Purple Heart, and severe PTSD, which manifested itself in panic attacks, nightmares, and acute agoraphobia, the fear of leaving his home, all of which he self-medicated with alcohol. Then a nonprofit organization contacted Luis and offered to partner him with a service dog. Desperate for any possible solution to his mounting problems, he went to a training facility in upstate New York, where he met Tuesday. I asked Luis how Tuesday had changed his life. "Well, Tuesday can anticipate my panic attacks by observing changes in my breathing or smelling my perspiration, so he'll nuzzle me and prevent me from having a panic attack." "Wow. If I'm having a nightmare and start thrashing around, Tuesday will jump on the bed and wake me up. And he broke my isolation. You know, you have to take a dog out a couple times a day, and I learned something. People don't like going up to a scruffy-looking wounded vet, but they do like coming up to a scruffy-looking wounded vet who has a beautiful dog." Luis told me that thanks in large part to Tuesday's help, he had turned his life around, enrolling in journalism school. After graduating, he went on to write a number of best-selling books about his experiences, including a couple of children's books about him and Tuesday, and became an advocate for other veterans. My grandson, Joe, just loves his book, Tuesday Takes Me There. In the period between the inauguration and my swearing-in, I learned as much as I could about service dogs. I spoke with a couple who now could go to the mall with their autistic son, who loved taking care of his service dog, even as his service dog was taking care of him. I met a veteran who told me his dog kept track of when he was supposed to take his medication and would tug him by the sleeve to remind him if he hadn't taken it. as scheduled. I visited a training facility in Minnesota where I saw a German Shepherd pick up a nickel with her teeth. Wow. As soon as I got to the Senate, I had my staff draw up a bill that would fund a 3-year Department of Veterans Affairs study pairing 200 dogs with veterans suffering from invisible wounds and measure the benefits to each veteran against the cost of training each dog, which were not insubstantial even when offset by all the stray nickels they could pick up. If it worked, we'd have evidence to argue for expanding the program more widely. A few days later, Drew and a couple of other staffers walked in my office with a sheaf of paper. There it was, my first piece of legislation. It was kind of a moment. Everybody was beaming. I sat down with the pages and began to scan them, making a few notes in the margins where I thought the amendment could read a little snappier. "Al," someone said, "what are you doing?" "Oh, just punching it up a bit." Blank stares from the team. "You know, making it sing a little bit. You know, so it'll be more fun to read." There was an awkward silence until Drew said, "No, Al, you don't do that." "Oh, yeah. Well, that'll save me a lot of work," I said, putting down my pen. In fact, as it turns out, not only do senators not do punch-up, they don't write legislation at all, and neither do their staffs. You may have seen a film strip in sixth grade on how a bill becomes a law, but the way a bill becomes a bill is via the Office of the Legislative Council. Senate staff from both parties bring in their bosses' ideas, and then a team of nonpartisan lawyers carefully translates them into unintelligible legalese in order to make sure that bills actually do what their authors want them to do. Can you even begin to imagine how depraved their holiday party must get? Anyway, I needed a Republican co-sponsor, so I called Johnny Isaacson from Georgia, who serves on the Veterans Affairs Committee. Johnny immediately said he loved the idea, and later he told me why. Johnny's mother had always hated dogs. When he was growing up, the family dogs were never allowed in the house. But Johnny and his wife, Diane, had a mutt named Sox, mostly black lab, but with 4 white paws, hence the name. Sox was an inside dog who loved to jump on the couch, and when Johnny's mom would come over to visit, that would always make her furious. But after Johnny's mom developed Alzheimer's, her mental state deteriorated to the point where she was in a near-constant state of agitation. And when she would stay with Johnny and Diane, there was just one thing that could calm her down: sitting on their couch, snuggling with Sox. So Johnny signed on, and the bill sailed through as an amendment to a defense authorization bill. A week after we broke for August recess, senators gathered in Boston to honor an actual giant of the Senate, Ted Kennedy, who had died after a long fight with brain cancer. Johnny approached me at the memorial. "Al," he said, "I've been getting a lot of great reaction back home for that dog bill of yours, even from non-veterans. If you ever have another bill you want co-sponsored, just let me know." "Oh, I've got one, Johnny. It's a bill for gay marriage and abortion on demand." Johnny nodded politely and said, "I'll get back to you." And you know what? He hasn't. I know that's kind of a fun ending to the story, but that's not the actual ending to the story. Even after Johnny and I got the amendment into the defense authorization bill, and even after the defense authorization bill passed the Senate, I had to find a member of the House to make sure the provision stayed in the final version of the bill. And even then, an authorization bill doesn't actually fund anything. It just authorizes stuff, hence the name. The actual funding has to come from an appropriations bill. So we had to then make sure that the defense appropriations bill had money for the study that had been authorized by the authorization bill. That's a much less fun ending to the story, and even that's not the actual ending. You see, it's been more than 7 years since my amendment passed, and that 3-year study still isn't finished yet. Now, how is that possible? Well, first, the study has to be designed, and since it involved both human beings and animals, it took a lot of extra time to clear both sets of compliance hurdles. And then once the study finally began in Tampa, it almost immediately hit some speed bumps. First of all, they can't do anything right in Tampa. I'm sorry, I've never been to Tampa. I'm sure it's great. I'm just cranky about the study. It turned out that one of the service dog providers picked for the study shouldn't have been accredited. After a couple false starts, the Tampa study eventually wound up being scrapped. I continue to meet periodically with a 3-person team from the VA in charge of the study. As frustrated as I was when things went wrong, they were more so. After they learned about the flawed accreditation system for service dogs, they redesigned the study, and as I write this, they've matched nearly 200 veterans with service dogs in 3 cities across the country, except this time, the dogs are being trained by VA trainers. Meanwhile, Purdue University has conducted a similar study, and their preliminary results are promising. Veterans who have been matched with service dogs have experienced less depression, less anxiety, a greater sense of satisfaction, and a reduced feeling of isolation. We're losing 20 veterans a day to suicide. I think my service dog idea could help. I hope I'm right. And I hope the VA's 3-year study will bear that out. When it's finally finished in 2018, 9 years after I got it approved. The story of my first bill is, in some ways, a story about politics at its best. I met a heroic American who gave me a good idea. I reached out to experts to craft legislation. I found bipartisan support, and we got it done. Nobody filibustered my bill, or lied about it, or sank it with a poison pill, or hired sleazy lobbyists to stop it from becoming law. But this is also a story about how, even when everything goes right, politics can be full of setbacks and frustrations. And sometimes it's even full of heartbreak. As I was putting this chapter to bed, I got the unfathomable news that Luis Montalvan had taken his own life in a hotel room in Texas. I guess I should say something here about how, despite this tragedy, I still believe in the potential of the idea. He and Tuesday, who wasn't with Luis at the time and is doing fine, that they inspired. Or maybe about how it's a reminder of just how imposing this challenge is, even if we all work together and do our best to address it. And that's all true. But mostly I'm just sad. As we worked together on this issue, Luis became more than just a symbol, more than just an ally in an important cause. He became my friend. And even as I worked to carry on the fight we shared, I'm going to miss him. Chapter 26. What gets me out of bed in the morning. Not long after getting to Washington, I started noticing the overuse of certain clichés, which I suppose is why they're clichés. For example, how often have you heard a politician say, "Growing up in state where I grew up, I learned the value of hard work." As if kids in the other 49 states grew up learning to slack off. By the way, I use this all the time, but only because growing up in Minnesota, I really did learn the value of hard work. Here's another one that drove me crazy. It's just the word robust, as in robust funding, which just means a lot of funding, or as in a robust response, which just means a strong response. No human being uses this word in casual conversation, but everyone in Washington uses it all the time. That's why I issued a fatwa against it in my office. No robust in speeches, no robust in press releases, no robust in robust letters calling for robust funding to ensure, another cliche, a robust response to a pressing problem. This policy held until I was trying to get a Republican colleague to sign onto a letter I had written to get stronger funding for Section 8 housing. My colleague reviewed the letter and agreed to sign on with one condition, that I had to change the word strong to robust. That's when I gave up the ghost. So if you ever happen to see me giving a speech and I use that word, you know that I deeply hate myself in that moment. Speaking of existential angst, another thing I noticed was that a lot of people in government kept saying things like, what gets me out of bed in the morning is making sure our veterans have good jobs. Or, what gets me out of bed in the morning is seeing to it that every child in America has a world-class education. Or, what gets me out of bed in the morning is doing everything I can to see that our electric grid is secure. I thought to myself, why is everyone in this town so depressed? What gets me out of bed in the morning is having to pee. Sometimes it's also what gets me out of bed in the middle of the night. In either case, I always go right back to bed. The next thing that gets me out of bed in the morning is Franny saying, it's morning and it's time to get out of bed. But I never get up right away. My first thought is usually, oh, I wish I could sleep some more. Then it's, man, I love to sleep. Then I think, oh, these covers are really nice and warm, too. And I like how it's cool on the underside of the pillow. That's a nice contrast. Then Franny will come in and say, come on, you really have to get up. I brought you some coffee. Then I think, coffee. How long can I wait to get up before the coffee gets cold? Then Franny comes back and says, come on now, really? You're being picked up in half an hour. I brought you another cup of coffee. And then I think, crap, I have to pee again. So I get up and start to tell Franny about the dream I was having about trying to get someplace but not being able to find it. Everyone has that dream, Franny will say, handing me a towel. Now get in the shower. The shower usually wakes me up, that and the coffee, and as I'm getting dressed in my suit, I start thinking to myself, it's great to be alive. Now I get to go to the Senate and fight for the uniquely hardworking people of Minnesota. Chapter 27, The Case of Perry Mason's Lost Case. In the Senate, the lion's share of your work gets done through the committees on which you serve, and you get your committee assignments from your party leader. A couple of weeks before I was sworn in, I met with Harry Reid. Harry told me he thought I'd be great on the Judiciary Committee. I pointed out that there are a lot of lawyers in the U.S. Senate, and that I wasn't one of them. That's why I want you there, Al. We need members with that perspective on judiciary. You'll be great. Of course, Harry was just BSing. I was the last senator to arrive, and he had a spot to fill on judiciary. During my first week in the Senate, the Judiciary Committee began the confirmation hearings of Judge Sonia Sotomayor for her nomination to the Supreme Court. As the most junior of the 20 members of the committee, I sat at the end of the dais, next to Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania. Arlen had presided over the most recent Supreme Court confirmation hearing for Samuel Alito as the Republican chairman of the committee. But as you will recall, when he switched parties and became a Democrat, the Democratic caucus had stripped Arlen of his seniority because he had made intemperate remarks about yours truly. It had to be more than a little galling for the former chairman of the committee to have to sit next to me. In an attempt to lighten what must have been an uncomfortable moment, I turned to Arlen when he took his place on the first day of the hearings and said, I'm sorry you have to sit next to a pisher like me. Pisher is Yiddish for pisher. Arlen smiled graciously, appreciative of my humility and my appeal to our kinship as members of a people traumatized by centuries of persecution. At least I think that was what was going on. I was the last member to make my opening 10-minute statement, becoming the first person in American history to have both participated in a Supreme Court confirmation hearing and also played a senator in a sketch about a Supreme Court confirmation hearing. I played Senator Paul Simon in a very substantive SNL sketch about the Clarence Thomas hearings. I used the time to develop my thesis that the Roberts Court was an activist court, making 1-5-4 pro-corporate ruling after another. That's a pretty common critique now, but I was actually the first judiciary member to make it. Court watchers were a little startled that this was coming from the comedian. As Republican members spent hour upon hour obsessing over Sotomayor's wise Latina remarks, Democrats picked up on my activist court theme. When it was time for my 30-minute round of questioning, I was set to bring it home. But I began by referring back to something Amy Klobuchar had asked Judge Sotomayor about earlier in the hearing, which is why Sotomayor had chosen to become a prosecutor. Sotomayor answered that she had been inspired by watching Perry Mason as a kid. I, too, had watched a lot of Perry Mason as a kid, and so I started my questioning by asking her why she was inspired to become a prosecutor by a show in which the prosecutor, Hamilton Berger, lost every case. And she said, actually, Perry Mason lost one case. Now, I wanted to get to my substantive point, so I said, well, we'll return to that later, not actually intending to do so, and I went into my questions. But with about 2 minutes left, I didn't really have time to develop my next line of questioning, so instead I just said, Judge Sotomayor, you said that Perry Mason lost one case. Yes, she responded. Which case was that? I asked. I don't know. I waited a beat and said, didn't the White House prepare you? Big laugh. My time had now run out, which meant the committee's questioning was over, and the senators on the committee went off to a separate room to receive a classified members-only briefing on the nominee's FBI background check. Meanwhile, the web was blowing up about my groundbreaking critique of the Roberts Court. No, it was blowing up about what case it was that Perry Mason lost. As we filed into the room where we were to receive the briefing, I was still sort of feeling like the new kid in school standing alone in the lunch line. I didn't really know any of the Republicans on the committee, beyond some passing niceties with Lindsey Graham and the Subway meet cute with Chuck Grassley. And then Tom Coburn of Oklahoma walked in and announced authoritatively, actually, Perry Mason lost two cases. And then Jeff Sessions drawled, you know what I liked? Dragnet. Then John Cornyn of Texas chimed in, I liked Highway Patrol. So, looking for a chance to bond, I said, I worked with Broderick Crawford. Crawford had been the star of Highway Patrol, but was also an iconic tough guy movie star who had won the Oscar for Best Actor in All the King's Men. And boom, every Republican in the room just stopped. You worked with Broderick Crawford? And I said, yeah, he hosted during the first season of Saturday Night Live. And I told them about how the Thursday of that week I'd been assigned to mine Crawford because it was St. Patrick's Day, and he started drinking very early in the day. Thursdays were the day we taped promos, usually around 1 in the afternoon, and I'd written a promo for Broderick and Gilda Radner where he had 5 lines and she had 1. But Broderick was already really soused at this point, so I took a line away from him, and he had 4 lines, and now Gilda had 2. Then I had to make it 3 and 3. By the end, Gilda had 5 lines, and Broderick had 1, and we got the thing on tape. Anyway, I'm telling this story, and suddenly all my Republican colleagues are going, you really were in show business. You worked with Broderick Crawford. So this was my first big breakthrough with my Republican colleagues. My point is, the Senate is filled not just with lawyers, but with old white men. By the way, the 2 cases that Perry Mason lost were the case of the deadly verdict and the case of the terrified typist. Chapter 28, The Angel and the Devil. Actors often claim not to read their own reviews. I don't know much about actors other than they're all liars, but I can say that most senators do look closely at their press coverage, and not just out of vanity. It's important for us to know exactly how our constituents and the general public see us, also vanity. The incisive critique of my questioning of Judge Sotomayor in Slate was particularly gratifying. Regarding my argument on the Roberts Court's judicial activism, Mr. Slate wrote, some of the only questioning along those lines came from Senator Al Franken, who made Sotomayor very uncomfortable as he grilled her on the Roberts Court's tendency to overreach. In this term's Voting Rights Act case, the court came close to striking down an act of Congress, and in an age discrimination case, it decided an issue that was never briefed. Franken politely asked Sotomayor, "How often have you decided a case on an argument or a question that the parties have not briefed?" He wondered whether that constituted judicial activism. Good question. Why was the junior senator from Minnesota, the one sworn in only a week ago, the first one asking it? Mainly, though, the press coverage of my performance focused on another question. What to make of my use of humor during the hearing? Was it an example of appropriate levity, or an early indication that I was going to be the Senate's class clown? The next day, MinPost, Minnesota's online newspaper dedicated to public policy, ran a think piece on just this question entitled, "Franken's Senate Debut, Appropriate Levity or Class Clown?" It was, I suppose, a balanced thumbsucker with weighty analysis from various experts. Larry Jacobs, an oft-quoted political science professor at the University of Minnesota, asked, "So why did he throw in the Perry Mason thing? Why did he not just go into his very reasonable questions about judicial activism? Instead, there seems to be a very driven need for cleverness." That is what set alarm bells off for me. Alarm bells. On the other hand, Guy Uriel Charles, a Duke law professor with a suspicious hyphenated first name, argued that the Perry Mason bit was a positive thing. Obviously, the risk is that he won't be taken seriously, that he will be viewed as a clown, Charles said. But oddly enough, it seems that if he played it as a straight man, without any humor, he would have been taken less seriously. Quite a needle to thread, don't you think? David Schultz, a political science professor from Hamline University in St. Paul, provided a secondary layer to the customary journalistic navel-gazing. The danger is that the main story becomes about his discussion with Sotomayor on Perry Mason, said Schultz. This was irritating. A pundit punditing about how other pundits might pundit. But it was also dead on. And indeed, the piece continued, the Perry Mason segment reverberated through headlines, stories, and TV clips throughout the evening and into the next day. My team took this all very seriously. They, too, were well aware that a lot of onlookers were waiting with bated breath for me to screw up. And they felt a lot of pressure, probably even more than I did, to stop it from happening. And in the wake of the Perry Mason incident, they became what I can only describe as hypervigilant, a concerned Paul Drake or a fretful Dell Street, if you will, to my cavalier Perry. Thus, new rules. I could be funny in the office, but only with members of the staff, not in meetings with visitors. It was okay to be funny on the floor with my colleagues as long as I wasn't loud enough to be picked up by C-SPAN microphones. And for God's sakes, no physical humor. After a few months of utterly humorless behavior in public, a reporter, desperate for something to write about, approached Jess McIntosh, who had come to Washington with me, to be my press secretary in the Senate. "Why isn't your boss funny anymore?" "Because of you guys," she replied. Doing a good job as senator was important enough to me that I was willing to restrain my urge to occasionally be funny around people who didn't work for me. But that doesn't mean it was easy. In fact, after a couple months, this is all driving me kind of nuts. Which brings me to a November 5th, 2009 hearing of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, or HELP, on which I also sit. We were discussing ENDA, the Employee Non-Discrimination Act, which prohibits discrimination against LGBT people in the workplace. As of this writing, there are still 30 states that don't have laws on the books protecting lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender workers. Gay couples can now enjoy all the rights and responsibilities of marriage, but if you get married on Saturday and then you both get fired for being gay on Monday morning, that's a pretty crummy way to start a new life together, don't you think? In 1993, Minnesota became the first state to ban employment discrimination on the basis of either sexual orientation or gender identity. At the very beginning, there were a few bathroom kerfuffles of the sort that might be a highlight in a Madea movie. But soon, everyone figured out that everybody has to go to the bathroom occasionally at work, and more important, that firing people because they're gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender is really cruel and dumb. Nothing bad has happened because of Minnesota's law, unless you're an employer in another state who lost a smart, hardworking, and very talented employee to a Minnesota company like 3M or General Mills or Target, or any one of our state's 17 Fortune 500 companies because of your state's intolerance and stupidity. The room was packed full of LGBT advocates there to observe the hearing, and of course a number of my Democratic colleagues, including Chairman Tom Harkin, were there to talk about this important issue. But the Republicans on the committee didn't seem ready to discuss ENDA that day because no Republicans, not even Ranking Member Mike Enzi, had shown up. This was pretty unusual. In my 4 months in the Senate, I'd never been to a hearing without at least one member of the minority present. As Chairman Harkin gaveled the hearing to order, a thought occurred to me. Wouldn't it be funny, I thought, if when I was called on, I said, "I think it's a shame that none of the gay members of the committee showed up today." I knew, of course, that telling the joke was a really bad idea. It would undermine everything I'd been working toward, to be seen as a workhorse and not a show horse, and yada yada. The yada yada came from the devil as he popped up on my right shoulder. "Come on," the devil yelled. "Tell the joke. It'll kill." "Now, Al," the angel appearing on my left shoulder said calmly, if a bit sanctimoniously, "you worked way too hard for far too long to do this, and you know it." "It'll kill," the devil screamed, hopping up and down. "The room is full of LGBT activists. It'll get a huge laugh." I tried to ignore the devil as Chairman Harkin gave his opening statement. A passionate champion of civil rights, Harkin had authored the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act, which changed millions of lives in our nation for the better. Qualified workers should not be turned away or have to fear losing their livelihood for reasons that have nothing to do with their capabilities, skills, or performance. Such practices are un-American, and it's time for them to stop, he said. At least that's what the transcript says, he said. The devil was drowning him out. "Come on, everyone will love it." The devil was positively vibrating with excitement. "Al," the angel warned, "you remember the reaction to Perry Mason."
"Screw the press. People loved it. Besides, this is much funnier, with much broader appeal."
"And will be much worse," said the angel. "The other side will accuse you of saying that all the Republicans on the help committee are gay."
"It's a joke," the devil snarled at the angel. "Everyone will know it's a joke."
"Of course they will, Al, but you know how this works," warned the angel. "They will all pretend they're deeply offended."
"Screw 'em, I tell you. It'll kill."
Now Jeff Merkley, the author of the bill we were considering, was quoting Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. "Human progress is neither automatic nor inevitable. Every step toward the goal of justice requires sacrifice, suffering, and struggle, tireless exertions, and passionate concern of dedicated individuals." But the cacophony coming from my left and right trapeziuses was making it hard for me to pay attention, and frankly, both the angel and the devil were making valid points. The devil pointed out that this was a very different situation from the Sotomayor hearings. Everyone had been watching those, but no one was paying attention to the ENDA hearing. Wasn't it possible by getting an enormous laugh I might bring more attention to the issue, and maybe help a lot of LGBT people? And hadn't some of my most passionate supporters insisted that it would be refreshing for me to use my comedic talent for just this kind of thing? The angel did his best not to scold, but he did point out that if I said the line, my entire staff might bolt from the Hart Senate office building and never be seen again. I started experiencing a kind of vertigo. You know that feeling you get when you're on the balcony of a very tall building and you start to panic because you realize you could just throw yourself off. For a moment or two, I had that feeling. I could just blurt, "I think it's a shame that none of the gay members of the committee showed up today," and then see what happens. Then things got worse, because all of a sudden the angel and the devil each sprouted their own angel and devil. The angel's angel was talking about losing my chance to feed the hungry and house the homeless. The devil's devil was talking complete nonsense about how Victoria's Secret models love to laugh. Merkley was wrapping up. It was my turn in a matter of seconds. Fortunately, the angel's devil and the devil's angel were hashing things out between themselves. "I know what your boss is worried about," the devil's angel said to the angel's devil. "But all our side is saying is that this place could use a little lightening up." "Sure," replied the angel's devil. "And believe me, I've been making that case on my end, but we have to pick our spots." "No doubt," agreed the devil's angel. "No one over here is saying we go for the joke every single time." "Well, the devil's devil is." "Oh, nobody listens to him." "Uh-huh," said the angel's devil, not really believing that. "Well, look, bottom line, I think we can work together, but we've got to look for the right opportunity, and this ain't it." "Fair enough," nodded the devil's angel. "I'll take it to my boss, and I guarantee you I'll get reamed out." The angel's devil rolled his eyes at this little bit of posturing. "But," the devil's angel continued, "I think he'll live with it, if you promise me that you'll get your boss to look for some opportunities to be funny that are less high risk." The angel's devil put out his hand. "We've got a deal." I was relieved. This was very good staff work, and just in time. "Senator Franken," said Chairman Harkin. I turned to my prepared remarks. Growing up, my kids read in history books about a time in our country when it was perfectly legal to fire someone or refuse to hire somebody because they were black or a woman. For them, it was a concept that they couldn't understand. I hope that my future grandkids will only read about when it was legal to fire someone because they were gay or transgender. As I read my opening statement, I thought of my actual staff up in our office blithely watching their boss on TV with no inkling of the anguished psychodrama I had endured, and how, for the moment anyway, my reputation and their jobs were secure. When it came around for my 5 minutes of questioning of Tom Perez, then Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights and eventually Labor Secretary, I thought back to the deal that the angel's devil and the devil's angel had struck. I decided it was finally time for a little good-natured humor. Me. I've also seen a real change in attitudes about gay and LGBT people. I'd say my kids' generation, I have kids in their 20s, thinks whether someone is gay or not is about as interesting as if they're left-handed. Now, I think it's a little more interesting than being left-handed, but laughter. Perez. I'm ambidextrous. Me. Yes. Laughter. I'm not going to touch that. More laughter. And from that day forward, it was okay for me to be mildly funny, in spots. Also, the devil's angel got fired, but sometimes you have to stick up for what you believe in. Final note, 4 years and 2 days later, on November 7th, 2013, Merkley's end of legislation passed in the Senate on a 64-32 vote, with 10 Republicans voting in favor. The Republican-controlled House, of course, refused to even consider the bill. And a majority of states still don't have protections against discrimination for LGBT employees on the books. And as for the deal the devil and the angel made, well, the angel got what he wanted. I behaved myself and resisted the self-destructive impulse to tell a joke regardless of consequences. And the devil got what he wanted. This book. Chapter 29. Never give the staff credit. When I was in Iraq and Afghanistan with the USO, I found myself paying particular attention to defense contractors and their employees. Many of these men and women serve with incredible courage and distinction, But there definitely seemed to be something of a rough-and-tumble culture among contractors. And of course, as civilians, they are not subject to military discipline. That's why, in addition to widespread waste, fraud, and abuse that contributed so egregiously to the chaos in Iraq and Afghanistan, it didn't surprise me when I heard reports that many female employees of those contractors had been the victims of sexual assault. If women in the military had little recourse in that horrific situation, their sisters who worked for contractors had even less. They had signed employment contracts that contained mandatory arbitration clauses. A mandatory arbitration clause requires the employee to resolve any employment dispute through a private arbitrator, often one selected by the employer. This meant that a female employee of a defense contractor who had been raped by a fellow employee in a war zone could not go to court against the contractor, even if the contractor had been grossly negligent in allowing the assault to happen. Her only recourse would be to go before an arbitrator selected by the contractor. Which brings me to Jamie Lee Jones, an employee of Kellogg Brown & Root, better known as KBR, who alleged that she had been drugged and gang-raped in 2005 by a group of KBR employees at the base in Iraq where she'd been quartered along with dozens of men. When I got to the Senate, she'd been trying for 4 years to take KBR to court, despite the mandatory arbitration agreement she had been forced to sign as a condition of employment. The Fifth Circuit in Texas had ruled in her favor, but KBR was appealing to the Supreme Court, which in a number of 5-4 decisions before and since had voted to expand the power of mandatory arbitration agreements and limit the rights of employees and consumers to get justice through the court system. Drew had the idea of introducing an amendment to a defense bill currently on the floor that would prohibit the Defense Department from hiring contractors who enforce arbitration agreements in cases of sexual assault, wrongful imprisonment, and other civil rights violations. Great idea, Drew. Let's do it. I rounded up a number of co-sponsors and brought the amendment to the floor, where we got word that the Republicans opposing it, led by Jeff Sessions, were planning to argue that the amendment was unconstitutional. So my Judiciary Council quickly got letters from 3 eminent law scholars, one conservative, one liberal, one middle of the road, arguing for the amendment's constitutionality. And I asked the Senate pages to place copies on every member's desk in the chamber before the debate. In the end, we won the vote 70-30, with only male Republicans voting against it. Defense contractors would no longer be able to enforce mandatory arbitration agreements against employees who claim they had been sexually assaulted. After more than 4 years of fighting to get in the court, Jamie Lee Jones finally had her case against KBR heard by a jury. Though she lost the case, she had her day in court, as have other women who have been or claim to have been sexually assaulted while working for defense contractors. Immediately following the vote, I held an impromptu press conference with a crush of press. "How'd you get the idea for the amendment?" a reporter asked. "My chief of staff, Drew Lipman, came up with it." I turned to acknowledge Drew, only to notice that his bald head was turning an angry shade of red. When we got back to the office, Drew calmly asked if he could have a moment with me alone. As soon as the door closed, he wheeled and bellowed, "Never give the staff credit! Never!" I was taken aback. But I was asked a question. Here's the concept, Drew explained to me that day. The senator is elected to office by the people of his or her state. Everything emanates from the senator. Every accomplishment belongs to the senator. Every once in a while, there is something called staff error, where a staffer can be blamed for something you screwed up. But any positive achievement, that came from you. So the idea of never giving the staff credit, that was all mine. When my grandson Joe was just 30 minutes old, I held him in my arms for the first time, looked down at his angelic face, and told him, "It's all staff. Let me explain what I mean to you, who might understand what I'm talking about, because the point was completely lost on Joe. As a senator, my main focus is on my committee work. For example, I serve on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. That committee is only important if you care about your health or your family's health or your education or your kids' education or your grandkids' education, or if you work, or if you plan to work someday, or if you plan to stop working someday and retire. That's one of my committees. Then there's a Judiciary Committee, which involves everything from Supreme Court confirmation hearings to immigration reform to law enforcement oversight to civil liberties and privacy issues, all of which are fascinating. And then there's patent law. I'm also on the Indian Affairs Committee, which covers a whole range of neglected and very thorny issues. And oh yeah, energy and natural resources, which deals with everything from water policy to nuclear labs to land management to the electric grid to, you know, climate change, that thing. So my main focus is literally on all of those issues. I also have to cast votes on other issues, like whether or not to bomb Syria. And for every issue, there aren't just two sides. There are dozens of sides. And each of those dozens of sides has advocates making the case who deserve to be heard and whose perspective I need in order to make the right decision. Plus, each issue has a ton of experts out there who have spent their entire lives learning about it, as opposed to me, who perhaps once wrote a funny sketch that sort of touched on it. Sometimes people ask, how do you keep track of all this information? How do you keep up on all these issues? And the answer is, I don't. You only have time for so many meetings a day. And you, or at least I, only have room in your, or at least my, brain for so much information at once. So your staff takes all the meetings you can't take and knows all the stuff you don't know. They're not just your eyes and ears, not just your representatives. They're the external hard drive for the computer, or in some of my colleagues' cases, the old-fashioned mechanical adding machine in your brain. On top of that, keep in mind, when you're a senator, you aren't just a senator. You are the public face of the office of the senator. That office is its own entity that communicates with the press, answers correspondence from the public, helps constituents with problems like delayed Social Security checks and visas for relatives living overseas, determines where you need to be and how you're going to get there, and a million other things that you have neither the time nor the expertise to do personally. You need people to do all this stuff and people to manage all the people who do this stuff and make sure they get their paychecks on time, and that there's paper in the printer. And also, in addition to your office in D.C., you have offices back in your state. And perhaps by now, you're beginning to understand why I have more than 40 people working for me. Congressional staff are chronically underpaid and underappreciated, and frankly, I don't have the time to deal with either problem right now. I'll try to remember to put someone on it. But if you've ever been watching C-SPAN and seen two senators engaging in a colloquy where they graciously thank each other for the long hours of work they'd put in, hashing out a compromise and hammering out the details of a piece of legislation, remember, they probably didn't do much of that. All the hashing and hammering was probably done by a handful of people in their mid-20s with hundreds of thousands of dollars in graduate school debt. It's possible that the two senators supervised their respective staffs every step of the way, getting into the weeds on the policy, receiving constant updates on progress, and giving strategic guidance at every turn. It's also possible that at least one of the senators needs his chief of staff to remind him whether his staffer's name is Jennifer or Jessica. The point is, it's all staff. On the other hand, when you're the senator, you're the only one who has to know at least something about everything. Your energy staffer is an expert on utility regulation and knows way more about it than you do, and that's great. But you still have to know enough about utility regulation to have a conversation with 30 members of the Rural Electric Co-op Association who are coming to see you at 10 o'clock. And also enough about Medicare payments to critical access hospitals to have a conversation with the Crow Wing County executive who's got an appointment with you at 10:30, and also enough about patent law to not look like an idiot when the president of the University of Minnesota and the CEO of 3M drop by at 10:45 to hear the latest on the very complicated patent reform bill that is somehow the single most frustratingly complex subject the Judiciary Committee deals with. Oh, and you still have to decide whether you want to vote to bomb Syria. You're the only one who has to know something about all these issues and take all of these meetings, not just in Washington, because you're also the only one who constantly goes back and forth between D.C. and your state and travels to every corner of your state. You're the only one in the caucus lunches with the other senators in your party. You're the only one in the classified briefings down in the SCIF, the Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility, a secure room where you can't even bring your cell phone in. You're the only one who makes calls to the parents of service members who have died. You're the only one who has to cast the tough votes. And by the way, you're the only one who's responsible for getting reelected every 6 years so that everyone else doesn't lose their job and have to go make twice as much money in the private sector. So yeah, it's all staff. But actually, as I tell my staff, it all comes from the top. Chapter 30, Letting My Id Run Amok. It didn't take long for me and Franny to establish a routine in Washington. I'd walk home from my office to the little house we had rented on Capitol Hill, Franny found it on Craigslist, where, during a quick but always delicious dinner prepared by Franny, we would discuss each other's days and muse about our hopes and dreams for our children, our country, and the world. But mainly I would complain about how much work I had to do. You see, after dinner, I would go to my den to do my homework. Mainly that's reading. Every night I'd go home from the office with a binder. Inside the binder is a schedule for the next day, usually loaded up with a wide variety of meetings, along with briefings for each one, so I know what I'm talking about when I sit down with those labor leaders or those activists for Alzheimer's research, or some guy wants to pitch a new postage stamp honoring Danish pianist Victor Borge. How did that guy get a meeting with the senator? Staff error. That's my binder. Well, it's one of them, the daily binder. In addition to that one, I have a binder for each hearing I'm going to attend the next day. One thing I didn't know before I got to the Senate is that witnesses customarily submit testimony in writing before the hearing itself, which means we senators get to read it the night before we question them. Not long after the press conference, where I stupidly gave Drew credit for my idea on mandatory arbitration, Judiciary Committee Chairman Pat Leahy scheduled a hearing on the issue. At hearings, each side gets to invite witnesses. Not surprisingly, Republicans had invited a witness who would testify in support of mandatory arbitration agreements, a lawyer representing the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The night before that hearing, I opened my judiciary binder and flipped directly to the testimony from the chamber stooge who was going to try to defend these indefensible agreements, a guy named Mark A. DiBernardo. A passage immediately caught my eye. The employee actually benefits from mandatory arbitration clauses, Mr. DiBernardo argued, because under arbitration, the employee prevails 63% of the time, compared to prevailing just 43% of the time in court. I thought. As a trained lie spotter, I had become intimately familiar with the right wing's most common techniques, including the deceptive use of statistics. And that one seemed downright suspect, especially since he used a very particular word like prevails. What exactly did that word mean in this context? I decided to dig a little deeper. In a footnote, DiBernardo had cited a source for his statistic, page 30 of a Congressional Research Service study. I called my Judiciary Committee staffer and asked him to track down the study so I could take a closer look. He found the study. It was only 10 pages long. Kind of hard to analyze a statistic that appears on page 30 of a 10-page report. The next morning, I woke up with a song in my heart and adrenaline in my blood. I took my seat at the end of the dais and waited patiently for my chance to question DiBernardo. Finally, it was my turn. Would a rape victim, I asked him, be deemed to have prevailed in an arbitration proceeding if she was awarded $50? DiBernardo started fumfering. Please answer yes or no, I instructed him. He paused uncomfortably. I say no. I had him. Okay, would a rape victim, under his definition of prevailing, be considered to have prevailed if she was awarded $100? You know, I think this is a distinction without a difference what we are talking about, but now I recognize the pivot when I saw one. Nice try. Answer yes or no, please, sir. He knew he was cooked. The question is, what is the number that counts as prevailing? I think that sort of is the question, isn't it? I said, try not to flash my incisors. DiBernardo stammered a bit more before giving up. I don't know. Aha, so when you said no before, you didn't know whether that was true or not, did you? Well, did you? Did you? Did you? Okay, the last two did yous were silent. Now, I'll bet Mark A. DiBernardo is a good husband and father, who just wants to provide for his family by defending a corporation's right to heartlessly exploit its employees and rip off its customers. But I was enjoying this, perhaps a little too much. Truth be told, I recognized the feeling. It was the same feeling I had gotten back in the old days when I realized just how far up Liar's Creek Bill O'Reilly was, claiming he had won two Peabody Awards and then claiming he hadn't said that. I can't help it. I love getting these guys. But now, instead of simply exposing the mendacity of a right-wing lying liar, I was standing up for everyone who had been the victim of a mandatory arbitration clause, the family who had to go before an arbitrator chosen by the nursing home that had allowed Grandma to die of dehydration, the women employees who had been paid less than their male counterparts at Walmart, but couldn't file a class action lawsuit because the Supreme Court had decided in another 5-4 Roberts Court decision that they had to go into arbitration as individuals. Maybe I wasn't allowed to be funny anymore, but I could still let my id out once in a while by eviscerating some right-wing jerk. It's not enough for you to kill these guys, Mandy Grunwald observed after one such evisceration. You have to set them on fire. Would you like another example? I bet you would. And I would love to relive it. As I mentioned in the powwow chapter, I made it onto the Indian Affairs Committee in the face of some stiff competition from no one. One day we were considering an amendment to the Indian Health Care Improvement Act that would allow dental therapists to provide oral health care to American Indian and Alaska Native children in woefully underserved Indian country. Children in Indian country have twice the rate of tooth decay as the general population. 68% have untreated cavities. 1 in 3 report missing school because of dental problems. More than 50 developed countries outside the United States have a licensed trade called dental therapist, mid-level oral health providers whose scope of practice is somewhere between a dental hygienist and a dentist. Guess who doesn't like that idea? Dentists. In 2006, the American Dental Association opposed, unsuccessfully, an experimental program that paid for Alaska natives to train as dental therapists in New Zealand and then return home to provide oral health care to isolated Alaskan villages, many of which are accessible only by air, and which would receive dental care just once a year when a dentist would fly in and stay for all of a week. The Alaska experiment had been successful. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, a Republican who had co-sponsored the Indian Dental Therapist Amendment with me, invited one of the dental therapists from Alaska to testify about the difference it made for kids to have an adult from their own village reminding them to brush every day and to take care of their cavities. And a pediatric dentist from Minneapolis testified that peer-reviewed studies showed that dental therapists improve access, reduce costs, and provide excellent quality of care. But the American Dental Association didn't want the competition from dental therapists, and so they opposed our amendment. They sent their president, Dr. Ronald Tankersley, to testify against it. The night before the hearing, there I was with my binder, reading his testimony, getting that old familiar feeling as my LIDAR began to tingle. "This year alone," he was planning to say the next day, "there will be 70 additional dentists providing care in tribal areas. With one more year of similar recruiting success, the shortage of dentists in IHS, Indian Health Services, could actually be eliminated." That couldn't be right, I thought. I called my staffer on Indian Affairs and asked for some real data. How many dentists are there in Indian Country? What's the shortfall? What's the attrition rate? He called back a few minutes later. Here was my end of that conversation. Oh, man, this is going to be fun. The next day, after Dr. Tankersley read his testimony, I asked him, "Shouldn't everyone have access to dental care?" "We believe they should," he answered. I repeated back to him what he had said about the 70 new recruits this year and about how, if there was similar success the next year, the dentist shortage could actually be eliminated. Was that his testimony? Yes. "Do you know how many dentists there are in the IHS?" "No, I don't." "There are 600 dentists in the IHS. Do you know how much the shortfall is?" Yes, the shortfall at this point is about another 70 dentists." "No, it is not." The shortfall, I told him, was about 25% or around 150 dentists. And did he happen to know the rate of attrition? "I don't know the statistics," he said, blanching a bit, "but the turnover rate is high." "So when you said that with one more year of similar recruiting success, the shortage of dentists in the IHS could be eliminated, why did you use the word could?" "Because there is no way we know that it will be eliminated." "Why'd you even bother to say it?" "Because the turnover rate is about 30%. I did the math for him. The current shortfall was 150 dentists. Turnover would add another 180. That made a shortfall of 330. 70 new recruits would still leave Indian Country about 260 dentists short. I asked him again if he agreed that everyone should have dental care. "We do." "It doesn't seem to me," I said, "that your testimony is convincing at all. And what I want to do is make sure that kids in Indian Country don't have rotting teeth. That is my responsibility." Of course, I have failed in that responsibility. Yes, our amendment passed, which means that dental therapists can serve in Indian Country, but only in the two states where dental therapists are licensed to practice at all, Alaska and Minnesota. 9 other states are now looking at licensing mid-level oral health providers. American Indians receive less than half per capita what we spend on health care for the average American. And that's a disgrace, one that even the most satisfying takedown can't eliminate. But at least that day I got my Indian name from a Minnesota Ojibwe friend of mine, Yells at Dentist. It's one thing to take on a professional association president who didn't prepare and doesn't know what he's talking about. It's way more fun to take on a right-wing ideologue from a conservative think tank. In 2011, Tom Harkin, chairman of the HELP Committee, called a hearing to talk about how we can build and strengthen the middle class. There is a classic philosophical divide between the two parties on how the economy works and on the government's role in creating jobs. The night before the hearing, I read the testimony of Kenneth Green, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and the designated conservative on the panel. Green's written testimony ended with this sentence: "In conclusion, the idea that the government can create jobs in the economy is a myth." Mm-hmm. The next day, I began my questioning by noting a few government projects that had created millions of jobs. Had Mr. Green heard of the Erie Canal? It opened European markets to Midwestern agricultural goods and timber and made New York the Empire State. The hearing itself, I noted, was being carried on C-SPAN, the cable satellite public affairs network. Was Mr. Green aware that the Defense Department had sent up the very first satellites? The hearing was also being streamed on the Internet. Did Mr. Green know that the Internet had been created by the government? How about rural electrification? The interstate highway system. Don't a lot of companies rely on the interstate highway system to ship their goods? And what about Mr. Green himself? His bio said that he had received his graduate degree from UCLA, a public university. Did any of his professors believe that they had jobs? Did any of them teach him anything? It would be absurd, Green finally admitted, to say that the government can't create jobs. I got in one last swing. When we receive testimony here in the United States Senate, I pointed out, we really like the testimony to say what it means and mean what it says. These hearings quickly emerged as one of my favorite parts of the job. The only problem was that there was a fine line between showing up a jerk and being one myself, between letting my id out and letting it run amok. And every so often, I'd go overboard. In 2011, we had a hearing in the HELP Committee to talk about chronic disease prevention. And one of the witnesses was a guy named Tevi Troy from the Hudson Institute, a right-wing think tank in Washington, who was there to complain about the Affordable Care Act. At one point, he was arguing that the ACA would force employers to drop health insurance for their workers because it would be cheaper to just pay the penalty than to pay for coverage. So I asked him about Massachusetts, where the reverse had happened under Romney Care. The percentage of companies insuring their workers had actually gone up, the only state in the country where that had happened. He cited a statistic from a study in the Wall Street Journal that showed that AT&T, for example, spends about $2.2 billion annually on covering its workers, whereas it would have cost only $600 million to drop the coverage and pay the penalty instead. Of course, AT&T hadn't dropped coverage because offering health insurance makes you a more attractive place to work and also keeps your workforce healthier and more productive, which is why more companies had chosen to offer insurance in Massachusetts, not less, which was the entire point. There might have been an interesting argument to be had there, but I got a little sidetracked by the words Wall Street Journal. You see, the Journal has a serious and trusted newsroom, but its editorial division pumps out a steady stream of absurd piddle-paddle, and right-wing hacks love to borrow credibility from the news department to support the nonsense on the op-ed page. So anytime I hear someone cite it, I get a little suspicious. Did the Wall Street Journal, I asked the witness, have a study or an editorial? It was a statistic cited in the Wall Street Journal, he answered a little nervously. Oh, man. Cited where in the Wall Street Journal? It was on the editorial page, he stammered. I had him. On the editorial page. It was an op-ed. Okay, I said, it was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. Yes. That's interesting, I said, or, if I'm being honest, smirked. The statistic remains accurate, he offered lamely. You know, I sneered. It's funny, the Wall Street Journal op-ed page, sometimes, I don't know if you know this, uses statistics in misleading ways. There was laughter in the room as the witness squirmed, but my healthcare staffer, Hannah Katch, quickly pushed a note in front of me. You're being an asshole. She was right. Not only was I focusing on the wrong thing, the editorial credibility of the Wall Street Journal, but I was badgering this poor guy. Immediately after the hearing, I thanked Hannah. Then I went straight to our office and called an all-staff meeting. Everyone piled into the conference room, wondering what this could be about. Hannah just handed me a note while I was questioning a witness, I said. I read the note aloud. Hannah did me an enormous favor. I don't want anyone in this office ever to be afraid to call me an asshole. Blank stares, a few nods. Okay, meeting over. Chapter 31. I Screw Up. As minority leader, Mitch McConnell constantly used, and I'd say abused, the rights of the minority in the Senate to slow things down. Things like nominations to the federal bench, or important diplomatic posts like ambassadors to Turkey, while jihadists were using it as a base to invade Syria. Or Sierra Leone, during the time it was gripped by the Ebola outbreak. Or South Korea, which is located just south of North Korea. Or key national security positions, like Undersecretary for Personnel and Readiness at the Department of Defense, Undersecretary for Nuclear Security at the Department of Energy, and oh yeah, Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. Now, it's one thing to stand up and filibuster something or someone you oppose. This was something else. On hundreds of occasions, the minority would use a parliamentary procedure called forcing a cloture vote simply to waste everyone's time. They did it more than ever before in history. In fact, 4 out of every 10 cloture votes in the history of the United States Senate up to 2014 came in the 8 years that Mitch McConnell served as minority leader. If you don't know what a cloture vote is, here's the deal. If the minority won't consent to proceed to a vote, the majority has to file a cloture motion to end debate. Passing a cloture motion requires 60 votes, so when you hear people talk about a filibuster, more often than not, it isn't Ted Cruz or Rand Paul talking for 16 hours. It isn't an exhausted Jimmy Stewart as Mr. Smith, his voice rasping from speaking through the night, collapsing as the gallery gasps. It's just the minority leader refusing to allow a bill or nomination to move forward. He doesn't have to say anything except, "I object," when the majority leader asks unanimous consent to go to a vote. The filibuster can be and is used to kill proposals that don't have strong bipartisan support. Mitch McConnell's innovation was using it constantly to slow things down that did have bipartisan support, just to make sure as little as possible happened that Obama could get credit for. You see, once a cloture motion is filed, it can't be voted on at all until an intervening Senate day passes. So if you file a cloture motion on a Monday, you can't vote on it till Wednesday. And even then, you're still voting on the cloture motion, not on the actual thing you wanted to vote on. If you get those 60 votes and the cloture motion passes, the Senate then has to wait for another 30 hours of, quote, debate to elapse before we can go ahead and vote on the dang bill or nomination. I put debate in quotes because, again, it's not like we spend 30 hours actually debating the topic. It's just a way of saying we have to kill a bunch more time. And in fact, in most of the situations, there wasn't actually anything to debate. McConnell would force cloture votes on ridiculously non-controversial stuff. So it was not uncommon for us to file a cloture motion on a Monday for a vote on, say, a non-controversial district court nominee, only to have the nominee confirmed with an overwhelming majority, in one case by a 98-0 vote, late on a Thursday evening. That's right. Republicans would routinely filibuster things that they'd then turn around and vote for. This wasn't just a thumb in the eye of that poor nominee who had to wait forever to become a judge or a postal regulatory commissioner or a member of the Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board. It was a deliberate strategy to prevent the Senate from moving to important issues we really needed to address. For a more in-depth discussion of how the filibuster is used to eat up time, check out my forthcoming 7th grade civics textbook, How a Bill Doesn't Become Law. What made it worse was that McConnell had made his intentions clear by actually saying, The single most important thing we want to achieve is for President Obama to be a one-term president. Not making sure kids get a great education, not creating millions of good jobs, not even getting our deficit under control. No, his first priority was about Republicans winning the next presidential election. I wasn't shocked that he thought that. I was just appalled that he actually said it. Mitch was really good at antagonizing the Democratic majority, which I think he'd take as a compliment. And perhaps that helps explain my first really big mistake in the Senate, which came during the debate on Elena Kagan's nomination to the Supreme Court. I was presiding over the Senate, which means I had to listen to speech after speech from conservative Republicans explaining why Kagan, who had been a clerk for Justice Thurgood Marshall and White House counsel in two administrations and dean of the Harvard Law School and Solicitor General under President Obama, was the least qualified Supreme Court nominee in our nation's history. As a Republican leader, Mitch McConnell gave the final speech against Kagan. It was awful. And at one point during his awful, awful speech, Mitch said, "No one has any doubt that Ms. Kagan is bright and personable and easy to get along with. But the Supreme Court is not a social club. If getting along in polite society were enough reason to put someone on the Supreme Court, then we wouldn't need a confirmation process at all." And I am truly embarrassed to report, listening to Mitch's awful speech, I rolled my eyes. Now, rolling my eyes at this patronizing sexist dreck about this extremely brilliant legal scholar that made her sound like a promising debutante might have been a very reasonable reaction for the ordinary observer, certainly for the ordinary Democratic observer. But I was not the ordinary observer. In fact, at that moment, I had the distinct privilege of presiding over the United States Senate. It is the duty of the presiding senator to listen to each and every colleague with respect, or, short of that, work on thank you notes or read press clippings. Rolling my eyes at McConnell was a huge breach of Senate protocol, which I compounded by shaking my head once or twice and worse, smirking at stuff I found particularly objectionable. In my defense, I was tired, which is a terrible defense. Fortunately, C-SPAN always stays on the speaker during Senate sessions, so there is no visual record of what was a very serious transgression. But as soon as Mitch had finished his speech, he marched up to the podium and let me know he was furious, as he had every right to be. "This isn't Saturday Night Live, Al," he said loud enough for the press to hear. Mitch is very smart, and for his purposes, this was exactly the right thing to say. After all, the political press had been itching to write something about Senator Yuck Yuck causing trouble by reverting to his old ways. I came back lamely with something about how offensive I had found his speech, which didn't impress Mitch at all. He informed me that if I ever did anything like that again, he'd call me out on it right there on the Senate floor. The Senate then moved to a vote on the Kagan nomination, and as I presided over the process, it quickly began to register that I'd really screwed up. I got to declare that Elena Kagan had been confirmed as a Supreme Court justice, which should have been a pretty fun moment, but my heart wasn't in it, and as soon as I finished my duties, I left the chamber and went directly to the minority leader's office. Mitch wasn't there, but I told his aide that I had come to apologize, and then I walked back to my office feeling terrible. By the time I got there, it was clear just how deeply I had stepped in it. I learned a couple things that day. First, don't smirk at a colleague, let alone the minority leader, when you're presiding. Second, when you're the senator and you really screw up, the job of the staff is to support you and not to tell you that you're an idiot and then leave the office in disgust. For that, I thank Drew, who went right into let's figure it out mode. I handwrote a note of abject apology to Mitch and walked back over to his office to deliver it personally. Then Drew and I and the press team composed a statement admitting my mistake, acknowledging that I had been completely in the wrong, and expressing my desire to apologize directly to the minority leader. The statement made the press accounts, and so did a statement from a McConnell aide. Senator Franken apologized, and that's a perfectly appropriate way of handling the situation. Both statements helped limit the damage, but especially the one from Mitch's office, which, of course, wouldn't have gone out without Mitch's okay. He had done me a real solid. And so I guess I actually learned three things that day, the third being that Mitch McConnell can actually be kind of a mensch. Once in a while. That day was the last of a long work period, hence me being tired, and afterward we immediately broke for the August recess. The night we returned to D.C. was especially nice, so I took a few members of the staff out to dinner at a Mexican place on Capitol Hill that has a little patio. Then I spotted Mitch and his wife, former labor secretary and current transportation secretary, Elaine Chao, dining al fresco at the restaurant next door. I walked over to them and started with some small talk about how much Franny had enjoyed getting to know Elaine through the spouse club meetings, which had the virtue of being true. Then I thanked Mitch for the statement his office had released. "Well," Mitch said, "we all make mistakes. What counts is that we learn from them." And from then on, I made it a point never to have an interaction with Mitch unless I had something nice to say. Usually that meant complimenting some speech he gave in a setting that was completely bipartisan. Mitch, that 9/11 commemoration speech you gave on the Capitol steps yesterday was really moving. Every year, the Spouse Club holds a dinner at which both the majority leader and the minority leader speak. Mitch's remarks at these are always great, which gives me at least one annual opportunity to compliment him. One year, he gave an especially beautiful speech, quoting from legendary former majority leader Mike Mansfield, a true giant of the Senate, about how we senators owe everything to our spouses. The next day, I approached Mitch on the floor and said, meaning it, "That was just a lovely speech last night." "Well, you can't go wrong quoting Mansfield," he replied modestly. We were standing alone. For some reason, I felt enough of a connection to take a risk. "Mitch," I said, "I have to say, I really like your speeches better that aren't in the service of evil." Mitch favored me with his best Grinch smile. Then he said, "I like the evil ones better." I laughed, and he seemed pleased. Now we're very close, and even though he and I may disagree, when we're off the clock, we're the best of friends. Sometimes we go out to dinner, and Mitch will laugh so hard that milk shoots out his nose. Chapter 32, Operation Curdle. Frankly, being civil with Mitch isn't always so easy. The fact is that his campaign of obstruction wasn't just obnoxious. It was deeply cynical, and ultimately proved to be downright dangerous. During his presidential campaign, Barack Obama had offered a refreshing and even inspirational vision of what our democracy could be. "We needn't be trapped by our old partisan divides," he told Americans. "We can change the tone in Washington. We can set aside our differences and recognize our common humanity. The cynics be damned. We should dare to hope for something better from our politics." "On this day," he declared in his inaugural address, "we gather because we have chosen hope over fear, unity of purpose over conflict and discord. On this day, we come to proclaim an end to the petty grievances and false promises, the recriminations and worn-out dogmas that for far too long have strangled our politics." To which Mitch McConnell basically responded, "Oh yeah, well screw you, buddy." Even before the inauguration, Republicans had decided that they were going to prevent the new president from keeping his promise to move the country beyond the rank partisanship that had consumed Washington. McConnell had laid out the strategy to his caucus at a resort in West Virginia that winter. Instead of working with the popular new president to pass his agenda or trying to find areas of compromise, Senate Republicans would focus on making the new president less popular. Journalist Alec McGillis, who reported on the summit in his book, The Cynic, The Political Education of Mitch McConnell, summed it up this way. In other words, wait out Americans' hopefulness in a dire moment for the country until it curdles to disillusionment. The way I see it, Republicans had three options for how to deal with the new political reality they faced in January 2009. Option one, recognize that the new president was hugely popular and had a mandate from the American people to deal with a series of pressing crises and ask, how can we help? Option two, recognize that the new president was hugely popular and had a mandate from the American people to deal with a series of pressing crises and say, congratulations, but we have some political standing too, and we're going to make you come to the table and negotiate, so let's sit down and work out something we can all live with. Option three, focus on reducing his popularity, refuse to respect his mandate, and as for those pressing crises, not only are we not going to help him solve them, we're going to do everything we can to prevent him from solving them, and then we're going to blame him for failing to solve them. In fact, after a while, we're going to start blaming him for creating the problems in the first place. Democrats and Republicans had faced this dilemma many times before, but never before had anyone ever chosen door number three. In part, Republicans were able to get away with Operation Curdle because of timing. When Franklin Delano Roosevelt took office in 1933, the country had been suffering with the Great Depression for almost 4 years. The message from the American people to the new president was loud and clear and universal. Do something, anything. Standing in his way would have been an act of political suicide. Even option two would have taken some real chutzpah. President Obama, on the other hand, took office just as the economic meltdown was beginning to peak. The day he took the oath of office, George W. Bush shook his hand saying, the economy is losing 800,000 jobs a month, stock markets in free fall, the foreclosure crisis is out of control, businesses are closing their doors across the country, I'm going home to Texas. Good luck. Then he left, only to pop his head back in. Oh, and there's still a war going on? Maybe a couple, not sure. Then he headed for the helicopter. Oh, hey, he shouted over the roar of the propellers. That Bin Laden guy? Never gonna find him. Anyway, I'm out of here. Then he and Laura flew away, waving goodbye to an economy he had left in ruins. The timing mattered not just because the most devastating effects of recession caused by Bush's policies were about to be felt under Obama's watch, but because the delay and the impact of the recession gave Republicans just enough wiggle room to play politics with it. Of course, while ordinary Americans were just beginning to realize how bad things were getting, economists had already issued dire warnings that, if dramatic action wasn't taken, the Great Recession could turn into another Great Depression. The numbers were scary, and the solution was clear, an emergency stimulus package that could put people back to work quickly, build shovel-ready infrastructure projects, and rescue state and local governments that were shedding teachers and other workers who were delivering desperately needed services. Economists agreed that, in order to be effective, this stimulus would need to be massive, at least $1 trillion. But political scientists agreed that Democrats had only 59 votes, and one of those votes, me, was at the time stuck in recount hell, which meant that in order to get the 60 votes necessary to break Mitch McConnell's filibuster and proceed to an actual vote on the stimulus, President Obama would need two Republicans. Desperate to find just two Republicans willing to help him save the economy, President Obama had to make compromise after compromise, eventually reducing the total package to $787 billion. On top of that, a couple hundred billion was diverted away from the direct spending economists were calling for and instead used to cut taxes for individuals and businesses. That's what it took to get Arlen Specter, who would soon defect to the Democratic caucus, and Maine's two moderate senators, Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins, on board. Thanks to those three and not one other Republican, the stimulus package barely broke Mitch McConnell's filibuster and passed in the Senate over the hysterical denunciations of the rest of the Republican caucus. And then, when it went to the House, Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats had to pass it all by themselves, It received not one single Republican vote, which Republicans celebrated like they just won the Super Bowl. A few of them even lit a cop car on fire. And then, having enjoyed making a big show out of refusing to help the president succeed, Republicans then turned to making a big show out of complaining that he had failed. In reality, he hadn't. The stimulus kept us from falling into another Great Depression and created millions of jobs. But it took a while to kick in, and it wasn't as strong as President Obama and Democrats wanted, or as economists had called for. It's hard to get people excited about avoiding a hypothetical depression when you're slowly muddling through a huge recession. The economy didn't feel stimulated, so it was very easy for Republicans to win the messaging fight. At a caucus meeting months later, Harry Reid reminded us Democrats that the stimulus had included the biggest middle-class tax cut in history. True. Sherrod Brown leaned over to me and grumbled sarcastically, "Yeah, I get thanked for that every day." People had no idea, because while the Bush administration had celebrated its 2001 tax cut by mailing taxpayers a letter at taxpayer expense announcing it, this time Americans simply had a little less withheld in every paycheck. Meanwhile, the construction jobs, the infrastructure upgrades, the shovel-ready projects all across the country, well, the Obama administration put up signs at all these sites. But the signs read, "Funded by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act." The what? Democrats have always had a disadvantage in messaging. Not because we're idiots, but because we have complex ideas and sometimes a hard time explaining them succinctly. Our bumper stickers always end with, "Continued on next bumper sticker." And by the time I got to the Senate in July, Republicans were giddily and successfully blaming the still sluggish economy on Obama's failed stimulus, which didn't stop them from simultaneously taking credit for stimulus projects in their districts, grinning widely for photos at groundbreakings and later ribbon cuttings. Not long after I got into office, I went to a groundbreaking ceremony in Maple Grove for a 3-mile, $47 million extension of Minnesota State Highway 610, made possible by an infusion of $27 million in stimulus funds. There were about a dozen public officials there, a few state legislators, a mayor or two, some county commissioners, and Senator Klobuchar and me. I was surprised to see Minnesota's 3rd District Republican Congressman Eric Paulson, who, like every House Republican, had voted against the stimulus, smiling under his hard hat. When I got up to speak, I said, "Well, I certainly don't deserve any credit for this. I got to the Senate after the stimulus was passed. I guess we should thank the members of Congress here who voted for the stimulus." I looked down the line of hard hats and said, "Okay, there's Amy Klobuchar. Let's hear it for Amy." Applause. "And let's see." I continued looking directly at Representative Paulson. "Well, I guess just Amy." Meanwhile, presiding over the Senate, I heard Republican senators claim that the only jobs created by the stimulus had been for federal bureaucrats. Presumably, these included federal bureaucrats who had moved to Minnesota to operate the excavators, bulldozers, compactors, and pavers to build the 3-mile extension of Highway 610. The stimulus had been a successful test run of the Republican strategy. Abdicate their responsibility to govern, obstruct the president's agenda, complain that things weren't getting better, and wait for Americans to get fed up so they could profit politically at his expense. Operation Kirtle was well underway, and any notion of building a better politics, any hope of changing the tone in Washington, was quickly erased. Soon after I walked into this mess, I asked a few of my veteran colleagues if it had ever been this bad. "Sure," a couple of them said. "Remember that guy who almost got caned to death on the Senate floor? Charles Sumner?" "Yeah, that guy." So the one time that anyone could think of when it was this bad was the near fatal beating of a sitting senator in the lead up to the Civil War and the deaths of more than 600,000 Americans. But then again, that was the summer of 2009. It actually got worse from there. That September, a South Carolina Republican congressman named Joe Wilson interrupted President Obama during an address to a joint session of Congress, shouting, "You lie!" It was a pretty shocking breach of protocol, but over the next 4 days, Wilson took in $1 million in campaign donations. Stuff like this was already becoming par for the course. Republicans had already decided to disregard President Obama's mandate, and some were even going so far as to question his legitimacy. After listening to one too many examples of a sitting congressman fanning the flames of the birther myth, I told Drew that I wanted the Capitol Police to install a special metal detector before the State of the Union address for any member of Congress who didn't believe the president was born in the United States. Drew thought I was joking. I think. But I made a serious case. If you believe that Obama wasn't born in Hawaii, I reasoned, it meant two things. One, you were generally insane. And two, you believe that the president was a usurper. Exactly the sort of people who should get wanded before being allowed into a room with a guy. "You can't do that," said Drew. "Okay," I said, "but if one of these guys plugs the president, you're going to feel pretty stupid." Republicans made huge gains in the 2010 midterms, seizing the majority in the House and picking up 6 seats in the Senate. Worse, these gains were powered and the new House majority controlled by the ascendant Tea Party. These folks weren't just extremely conservative. They were openly uninterested in actual governing. They saw themselves not as legislators, but as revolutionaries. More than a few of them were just plain nuts. All year, they've been raising hell at town hall meetings, complaining about everything from the Affordable Care Act, more about this in a bit, to the president's secret Muslim heritage, more about this, I'm guessing, in Donald Trump's presidential memoir. Now they had come to Washington, and what's more, they were clearly running the show. At the 2011 State of the Union, I walked in with Rand Paul, the libertarian new senator from Kentucky, who had chosen me to be his mentor. Let me explain. After the 2010 election, I called all the winners on election night to congratulate them and welcome them to the Senate, even the Republicans. I thought that was what you do. It isn't. I guess I was the only Democrat who called Rand, and we had a nice conversation. So Rand picked me to be his Democratic mentor. He picked Texas Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson for his Republican. I hadn't even been aware that there was a mentor program because I had been seated so late. Long and short of it, I was a terrible mentor. I advised Rand to be a workhorse and not a show horse, not realizing that he was planning to run for president at the first opportunity. Every once in a while, I'd ask Kay, "Is he listening to any of your advice?" "No," she'd say, slightly puzzled. So we walk into the House chamber, and I gave Rand some mentorly advice. "Rand, if the president says something you don't like, your job is to stand up and yell, 'You lie.'" Rand laughed and then added, "Actually, you know, that would be pretty good for fundraising." The chamber was crowded, and I had to scramble to find a seat. Lining up next to Marco Rubio, another new Republican senator, I tried my joke again. "Marco, some advice. If the president says something you disagree with, get up and yell, 'You lie.'" Chuckling, Marco responded, "That'd be great for fundraising." I turned to my other side and poked Saxby Chambliss, a veteran Republican. "Saxby," I said, "I just told Marco that if the president says something he doesn't like, he should get up and yell, 'You lie.'" Saxby laughed and said, "Not a bad fundraising tactic." The message had clearly gotten through to Republicans, even the non-crazy ones. Not only were they not being punished for the strategy they'd embarked upon at the beginning of President Obama's term, but they were being rewarded for it by a conservative base hell-bent on destroying the guy. And so, instead of trying to tamp down the most extreme elements of their party, Republicans indulged them time and time again, sometimes even egging them on by promising victories that they knew were impossible, just to keep them on board and engaged. This dynamic manifested itself in years of ugly brinksmanship. For example, raising the debt ceiling had always been relatively routine, but with the Tea Party pulling House Speaker John Boehner's strings, it became an opportunity to take the fiscal future of the country hostage. Sign Paul Ryan's radical austerity budget into law, they threatened, or we'll force America to default on its debt for the first time ever. That's what these guys were about. As my friend Norm Ornstein, the guy who played Norm Ornstein for Indecision 92, and his less funny colleague Tom Mann would later write in their book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, this new Republican Party was, quote, an insurgent outlier, ideologically extreme, contemptuous of the inherited social and economic policy regime, scornful of compromise, unpersuaded by conventional understanding of facts, evidence, and science, and dismissive of the legitimacy of its political opposition. Even after they failed to defeat President Obama in 2012, Republicans had gone too far down this path to turn back. They had trained their base to respect nothing and to expect everything. While the GOP's official post-election autopsy urged moderation on issues like immigration, the activists who ran the show concluded that Mitt Romney had lost because he wasn't extreme enough. By the end of President Obama's second term, Republicans had failed to keep any of the promises they had made to keep the Tea Partiers on board and engaged. They hadn't repealed health care reform or defunded Planned Parenthood or proved that the president was born in Kenya. All they had done was break the damn government. With Republicans putting up a unified front of opposition, we made no real progress on big issues like immigration or tax reform. Even after the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, we couldn't get an extremely mild gun safety bill through the Senate. And of course, they shut down the government for 16 days in 2013, costing the U.S. economy $24 billion. And the thing of it was, ordinary Americans who weren't themselves rabid partisans saw all this happening and blamed both sides. I was always amazed when I would go around Minnesota and meet people who didn't follow national politics that closely, but who knew that Republicans had been extremely uncooperative during the Obama administration. I know, I'd say, it's awful. Yeah, these people would often respond, but that's Washington for you. I never fully understood this a pox on both houses mentality until I read an article by Jonathan Rauch in The Atlantic last summer. He was talking about a study by a pair of political scientists in which they found that between 25 and 40% of Americans have a severely distorted view of how government and politics are supposed to work. Rauch calls these people politophobes. They see the contentious give and take of politics as unnecessary and distasteful. Specifically, they believe that obvious, common sense solutions to the country's problems are out there for the plucking. The reason these obvious solutions are not enacted is that politicians are corrupt or self-interested or addicted to unnecessary partisan feuding. These folks didn't reach that conclusion without some help. Many political reporters can't seem to write a sentence about a problem without casting at least some blame onto both sides. Congressional Republicans knew that and made hay with it. McConnell and his friends consistently blamed Obama for the partisanship of the Obama years, managing to suppress their giggles all the while. And too many journalists bought it. Take, for example, this blood-curdling artifact of Operation Curdle, a piece in Time magazine by Mark Halperin from December 2009, identifying the root cause of Obama-era partisan rancor. Once the new president cast his lot with his party in passing an economic stimulus measure rather than seeking bipartisan agreement, rival Republicans started digging in. Fortunately, the press cleaned up its act before 2016. Speaking of which, as the 2016 presidential campaign unfolded, and it became clear that Donald Trump might actually become the Republican nominee, pundits searched their pundit brains for answers to where the Trump phenomenon had come from. pinning the blame on everyone from Sarah Palin to Richard Nixon to Kim Kardashian. But the answer was right there in front of us the whole time. Yes, Donald Trump's takeover of the Republican Party had roots in the fact-free right-wing media bubble and in Newt Gingrich's pioneering of the politics of personal destruction in the 1990s. But his campaign grew directly out of the strategy Mitch McConnell implemented beginning at that retreat in West Virginia after Barack Obama won the White House in 2008. A strategy of total war against a Democratic president. A strategy in which no attack, no matter how false or outrageous, was out of bounds. When Republicans chose door number three, when they chose to become insurgent outliers, they unwittingly opened the door for Donald Trump. For the fat cat donors, special interest lobbyists, and elected officials who usually run the Republican show, wrote David Corn of Mother Jones, Trump is an invasive species. But he has grown large and strong in the manure they have spread across the political landscape. And after 8 years of refusing to help the president govern, in fact, 8 years of actively trying to make the country ungovernable, Republicans hadn't just created a monster within their own ranks. All that inaction and gridlock helped to create a nation of politophobes, people who correctly felt they were being left behind in the economy and correctly felt that the political system was broken and rigged against people like them, and extremely incorrectly felt that everyone who had anything to do with politics was more or less equally to blame. Rausch writes that these voters are inclined towards leaders who will step forward, cast aside cowardly politicians and venal special interests, and implement long overdue solutions. These leaders can be politicians, technocrats, or autocrats, whatever works, Rausch adds. Whether the process is democratic is not particularly important.